once I got the first three notes, da da da, then I said, where else can I go? Then I said, where else can I go?
You know, he had a very clever way of weaving the melody throughout the film.
It's actually a BBC first.
In addition to being able to write a film score, he was able to write hit songs.
Just suggests this sense of wonder and of possibility.
Because I believe that melody is the soul of communication with people as far as entertainment goes. You know?
I mean, this was the hippest music around.
The winner is Henry Mancini.
Mr. Henry Mancini.
I was having a little hot chocolate with a friend of mine, and I get this tap on the shoulder. Young couple there, and they said, are you Henry Mancini? I said, well, yes, I am. I said, you dropped your credit card. The first movie I was ever conscious of the music in was a movie my dad took me to called The Crusades. And he took me in 20 miles to the big city, to Pittsburgh. I thought there was an orchestra behind the screen. You know, I was my eyes were wide open. But that's what gave me the start.
Well, you know, he was born in Cleveland, Ohio, but he was raised in a town called West Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, and it was a steel town. And when my grandparents came over from Abruzzo in Italy, they settled in this steel town, and my grandfather worked in the mills. Steel was what was going on.
Every 8 hours, a shift change. 15,000 men to the shift.
You know, when you wake up in the morning with the soot on your collar, you go outside and you start to breathe and you start to cough at the same time. I thought that I wasn't long for that place. I thought I better do something to get out. And my dad knew that too.
And my grandfather handed him a piccolo and a flute when he was about 8 or 9 years old. And he wanted him to play this music because he didn't want my dad to get involved in the steel mills. He wanted him to become a music teacher. But, you know, his dad really never appreciated the fact that dad became who he became.
There's no such thing as an unstern Italian father. No, they're very stern. Yes, they're violent, too. They hit people, little people. Well, he had a stick for about 2 years. He would beat time on the music stand. He'd be beating like this. And, of course, if I missed a note, I got beat, you know, whacked.
You know, that's something my dad would tell you he never really got over. He never got the love from his dad as far as what he did with his life and his career.
But who would have told me? I don't know. That's the only way I got into it.
Once I got the first three notes, then I said, where else can I go?
10 p.m., BULOVA, Boulevard Watch Time, WABC, New York.
Chesterfield brings you the Moonlight Serenade. And now, here's Glenn Miller.
Henry Mancini became fascinated with the big band era and then went on to study with a professional arranger named Max Adkins in Pittsburgh. This was sort of the key to his future career, because Adkins knew major big band players who would come through. And through them, Mancini was introduced to people like Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller, and then went on to study more seriously at Juilliard. It was during that period that he was drafted into service during World War II.
All America alters its pattern of life and work to meet the demand for protection, working to win for the ways of freedom.
I'll tell you, it got me out of a lot of scrapes. When I went to the service, most of the time I was in the service band. It got me out of KP and all of that business. So I owe that flute quite a bit.
I don't think he ever saw any action except on the boardwalk in France when, you know, they were watching women go by. That was all the action he probably got in the war.
We're getting further south, all right?
Certainly getting warmer.
Right.
I believe he may have met Colonel Miller. He really was hoping to become part of the Glenn Miller band.
Major Glenn Miller, the well-known American band leader, is reported missing. He left England by air for Paris 9 days.
And when he came out, he found, quite naturally, a position in the successor to Glenn Miller's wartime band, headed by Tex Beneke.
Yeah, that was after the war. That's where I really started playing, and then I decided I wasn't a good enough player.
That eventually led to him getting a job at Universal Pictures in 1952.
I could not buy those years with any amount of money. I learned the trade from the bottom up. I did every sort of movie.
The great thing about Henry Mancini is that he is a kind of transitional figure in film music between the classically trained and mostly European composers in the 1930s and 40s. So people like Max Steiner and Eric Wolfgang Korngold and Franz Waxman and Miklos Rozsa. But when Mancini came along in the 1950s, he was the first to emerge from the big band era, someone who not only had a first-hand knowledge of jazz, but who had played in the big bands. So for the next 6 years at Universal, he became the guy on staff who understood more popular music forms.
You know, when someone really wants something way inside, and they want it hard enough, they usually get it.
He was asked to write the score for the Glenn Miller stories starring Jimmy Stewart, and out of nowhere, he gets an Oscar nomination for the score. And he continued writing as a staff writer, and he was doing films like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Tarantula, you know, real serious B movies.
I sound brash and more like a banker than a scientist. Try to remember that it takes money to run an institute like ours.
Universal let its music department go in early 1958.
And he was basically done. They let him go as a staff writer.
But one of the filmmakers he had worked with was Blake Edwards. The two of them had met on a picture called Mr. Corey, starring Tony Curtis.
And he went over to the Universal lot for the last time, and he was getting a haircut on the lot. And he came walking out of the barbershop, and he ran into Blake Edwards. And Blake said, "Hey, I'm doing a TV series called Peter Gunn. Would you like to score it?"
It was a show about a private eye whose hangout was a roadhouse. And in the club, they had a five-piece jazz group. So that set up the type of score.
That is the start of the Mancini sound.
Anyone falling through the skylight would land here, right on top of the piano.
Small combo, light, definitely cool.
You might have a point.
When it went on the air in the fall of 58, became a sensation, predominantly because of the score that Mancini had written.
The album won the very first Grammy for Album of the Year. And that really put Henry on the map 2 or 3 years before Breakfast at Tiffany's.
I mean, this was the hippest music around.
I play a very sparse piano, you know. Did you notice my left hand never moved?
So if you look closely at the liner notes from the original Peter Gunn soundtrack, you'll see one Johnny T. Williams billed as pianist. That's the John Williams that we now know today as one of the most successful film composers in history. In fact, he was a much-in-demand piano player, and Mancini employed him for the Peter Gunn and Mr. Lucky television scores.
It is part of my job to investigate each and every new face, especially if the face happens to be so unusually beautiful.
Mancini was not crazy about the traditional way of recording film scores, you know, hanging one or two mics over an entire orchestra and then having everybody play together. He insisted that many of the individual instruments be closely mic'd so that he could then control them in the mix so that they would be the most effective imaginable.
It gave me a lot of chance to do a lot of underscoring of all of the kind of music that we used to use string tremolos for, all that kind. Instead, it was, I guess what was different about it was that instead of the string tremolo, you heard these very chilling bass flutes coming at you.
So bass flutes tend to disappear if you're talking about a live performance. But when they're closely mic'd, what you get is a kind of dark ambiance, just right for crimes being committed in the dark.
Creepy crawly, I call it. You know, it's suspense, all of that business.
And that was an important thing to him, which was to apply modern recording techniques in recording film and television music.
Buy some furniture and give the cat a name.
Once I got the first three notes,
Then I said, where else can I go? Da, 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 where? Da. It just worked out that way.
They wanted me to do the score, and whoever to do the song. And so I asked Blake, I said, Blake, you know, I think I can write a tune now. I said, let me write something. If you like it, fine. If not, you can have it, you know. So Blake said, okay, you got a shot.
In the script for Breakfast at Tiffany's, there's a scene where Audrey Hepburn leans out of the window and sings a song from her past. Mancini had heard her sing in the movie Funny Face, so he specifically wrote a song within Audrey Hepburn's personal range and then asked Johnny Mercer to write a lyric for it that would hint at Holly Golightly's mysterious past.
Two drifters off to see the world.
In the South, in America, huckleberries grow profusely, wild, just like blackberries and wild cherries do.
He took it home with him, came back with two or three lyrics in about two or three days, and we decided which one we would use. And the first time I read that lyric, it scanned so beautifully, and when I got to Huckleberry Friend, there was no question in my mind what that meant, and it was a new word in the English language, or a new phrase, let's put it that way.
My huckleberry friend, oh, river and me.
In the Truman Capote, I think he called it a novella, there were just two lines where they said that she sang. I never thanked him for that either.
May I have the envelope?
Because if he hadn't put that little two lines in that little book, I would have never had the chance to even have the song in the script. Thank you, Truman, wherever you are.
The winners are Henry Mancini and Johnny Mercer from Moon River.
I mean, the first thing is it's an incredibly simple melody. If we take it in C major, you can play the whole tune on the white notes of the piano. You only have to hear three notes. And I think even just looking at those three notes, just something about that immediate sort of big lift and the small fall that just suggests this sense of wonder and of possibility. And then we have this scale down. There's something so simple and so serene about that. And then he repeats that line, but with this rising seventh, which is just one of the most expressive and yearning intervals there is. So that's an 8-bar first line. And then we have this 8-bar, the sort of B section. I love this chord coming out. Initially, he said he spent a month tinkering with it, but then actually when the melody came to him, it took him half an hour to write the song. And then I think the words, which hark back to these landscapes of Mercer's childhood in Savannah, Georgia, it's really a love song to the idea of romance. And then we have this really elongated phrase that just goes on forever. it is being extended. And again. There's something about the way that line just continues at the end. It's extraordinary.
Dear Henry, I have just seen our picture, Breakfast at Tiffany's. A movie without music is a little bit like an aeroplane without fuel. However beautifully the job is done, we are still on the ground in a world of reality. You are the hippest of cats, and the most sensitive of composers. Thank you, dear Hank. Audrey.
We had a big preview, so we all go up to this hotel suite afterwards, and Audrey's there, and everybody was ecstatic, and the head of the studio is standing by the fireplace. I can see him today. And he said, well, the picture's great, but the goddamn song has to go.
And that's when Audrey famously stood up and said, over my dead body.
A girl can't read that sort of thing without her lipstick.
The other one, which really expressed his personality, was Pink Panther.
I understand that the picture features the music of Henry Mancini.
We tend to think of it as the theme for this sort of smart aleck, Pink Panther animated figure. But in fact, that tune originated as the sort of stealthy cat burglar theme for the David Niven character in that movie. When Mancini learned that there were going to be animated titles with an actual Pink Panther, which was the name of the diamond in the story, he found that the Niven theme actually kind of worked as a stealthy, cool jazz piece. And so that became, of course, the Pink Panther theme.
You know, the tenor sax, Plas Johnson played it, and an ad-lib solo, an ad-lib jazz solo on a record, you know, that's reaching for heaven, you know?
You know, one other thing that's not often talked about, Pink Panther, so that was around 61. Studios in L.A., there were no African-American musicians. Zero. And Henry had discovered a saxophone player named Plas Johnson, and Henry hired him to do the score. I would propose that a lot of the success of that song was the sound that Plas brought to it. It's very unique. And with the success of that, suddenly Plas was on every session, and it opened the doors for African-American musicians to come into the LA studios. A few years later, Quincy Jones, who had become a superstar as a producer, he wanted to jump into the film scoring business. One of the Universal executives called Henry and said, do you think Quincy Jones could handle a film score? Well, the question he was asking was, do you think a black jazz musician could handle this? And Henry said, are you kidding? He's Quincy Jones. Hire him. And for that, Quincy attributes Henry Mancini for opening the door for him to have a film scoring career.
Better than ever. Dear, I doubt if we shall need it tonight, my love.
I'm sure we won't, darling.
You know, we tend to think of Henry Mancini as this sort of light romantic comedy composer. But in fact, he was as good a dramatic composer as anyone on the scene. For example, you take something like Experiment in Terror, and the main musical sound of that is actually two auto harps played using guitar picks by two of the best guitarists in Hollywood at the time. And if you go a little farther down into the 60s and you think about Wait Until Dark, the great Audrey Hepburn suspense film, that's a very unsettling sound of two pianos, one of which is tuned a quarter flat.
I conceive scores in sounds, not only in melodic lines, but in sounds.
Thank you.
you're right, he was quite ahead of his time. You know, he grew up in the big band era, right? But in 58, he wrote an album called Mr. Lucky Goes Latin, and on that is a song called Lujan. Well, Lujan is an actual percussion instrument. It's very unique. You rarely ever hear it. It can play six notes. And Henry wrote this song, and it had nothing to do with anything that was being done in the big band era. Very few people know it by name, but you'll know it immediately when you hear it.
Dad liked to go, when he traveled, which he did a lot, if it was Australia, he'd pick up a didgeridoo. If it was in Africa, which he went to a couple of times, he would bring home all of these really interesting instruments and incorporate them into his scores. So you hear some things. He liked experimenting, there's no doubt about that.
I would say that the initial colossal success of the early to mid-1960s led to a kind of inevitable downturn, not always getting the A-list movies that he probably would have liked. So there are a lot of B movies, I think, in the 1970s and 80s that are perhaps forgotten today or perhaps weren't very good as movies.
You know, I think professionally, I think he was pretty happy with all of his associations and creations with directors and producers. He did score an Alfred Hitchcock film years ago, and he was so excited. And as sometimes happens when the director isn't happy with the score, they, you know, get someone else to do it, and they dumped Dad's score. He told Dad it was too macabre, too creepy. And for Hitchcock, that's, you know, I don't even know what that means. And that really upset him. But I think personally that his biggest disappointment was that his father didn't acknowledge the success that he had become. So for my dad personally, I think as far as those kind of regrets, that was one of them. I don't think they ever resolved that.
Quite unique to Henry Mancini was that in addition to being able to write a film score, he was able to write hit songs. You know, the greatest writers now, Hans Zimmer, whoever you might be thinking about, that's just not what they do. Henry was really unique in being able to write a great song and then weave it through his films. One of the best examples of that is The Days of Wine and Roses. He won an Oscar for that. And you hear that song starts the film with a solo French horn playing a C and an A. And then he weaves that theme all throughout the film. And then when it gets to the last scene, and it's a heartbreaking scene with Jack Lemmon and Lee Remick when she can't stay sober and he realizes that he's losing her for good.
When is Mommy coming home?
Honey, Mommy's sick.
And Henry, she's right at that moment, has the French horn play that solo C and A. And it's when you hear that that your heart breaks.
I think he was happy to have the career he did. And while we tend to think about the more lighthearted pieces, I think he was a realist about the fact that they made him a bankable concert artist.
It's paid for quite a few things in our house, you know.
And in fact, Henry Mancini was the first film composer to become a household name in America. People like Max Steiner and Korngold and Rosia and Waxman may have had Oscars, but it was Henry Mancini who was the first to go on talk shows, to concertize with his own music around the country, and to become a kind of public figure. so that by the end of the 1960s, you could mention the name and you could picture his face. He even had his own television show in 1972. And since that time, really only John Williams has matched the fame and success of Henry Mancini in terms of popular hits and the ability to attract big crowds at concerts.
I think what I do has the ability to appeal to a greater number of people, and I think that's what middle of the road the term means.
Yeah, I mean, he was hired to write a theme, you know, and then the themes just were very melodic and catchy. And so if you watch Breakfast at Tiffany's today, by the time you're done with it, you're humming Moon River. He had a very clever way of weaving the melody throughout the film, and it just ties everything up with a bow at the end.
I love happy endings.
He was a master at that.
Mancini was diagnosed with cancer in the early 1990s, and it was a shock, I think, to the entire Hollywood community. But I remember during that last year, on his birthday, there was a giant concert held at UCLA, and much of Hollywood turned out for it. I don't think I've ever seen as great an outpouring of love and warm feeling as I did that night. Virtually everybody he'd ever worked with was there. It was a sign of not just their respect, but their love for this great musician who had in many ways changed the sound of film music and created an awareness of film music that had not previously existed in the public.
The melody is really the secret. And fortunately, being of Italian ancestry and having grown up with opera in the house and playing the flute and all of that business, I took naturally to it. My heart.